Once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Full details are at offbeatoregon.com. Check it out. But first, sit back and relax. Let me tell you the story of the most important submarine in Oregon history. A Japanese submarine, which made several visits to Oregon during World War II, launched a bunch of shells, tried to light a forest fire, sank some merchant ships, then disappeared over the horizon, and currently it's on the ocean floor somewhere near Vanuatu. I'm talking about the Japanese submarine I-25. This story was first published on January 30th, 2011, under the headline, Japanese Submarine I-25 Blasted Its Way Into Oregon History Twice. Here we go. In late August 1943, the crew of the destroyer USS Patterson scrambled the battle stations off of the coast of what is now Vanuatu, near Australia. The sonar operator had picked up the signature of a big Japanese submarine submerging close by. Patterson steamed into battle, depth charges rolling off the deck and lighting up the sea below. Then, on the final depth charge barrage, a deep undersea explosion could be heard, bigger than any depth charge. The Patterson had found its mark. And after that day, the most important submarine in the history of the state of Oregon, the Imperial Japanese Navy's I-25, was never heard from again. I'd like to call the I-25 Oregon's favorite enemy sub. The I-25 was one of the large fleet subs that the Japanese Navy put out to sea during the war. It was built in 1935, and the boat was 357 feet long and packed a large collection of torpedoes, a 5.5-inch deck gun, and even a fold-up seaplane. The reason the I-25 is so important to Oregon stems from a visit it paid to the Beaver State the year before it sank. In the course of that visit, the I-25 sank two merchant ships, shelled a coastal battery, and sent its airplane ashore to try and start a forest fire. It left Oregon not that much the worse for wear, but the psychological effect was considerable, as Oregonians wondered if this were just the beginning, and realized that if it was just the beginning, they'd be right on the front lines. It wasn't, of course, the beginning of anything. It was just a single submarine. A single, very busy submarine. The I-25 left Yokosuka, Japan in the spring of 1942 and headed east across the Pacific Ocean, headed for Alaska and points south. 2 months and one heavily damaged freighter later, on the night of June 21st, 1942, the submarine was following a fleet of fishing boats toward the mouth of the Columbia River. It followed the fishing boat so that if it were picked up on radar, the operator would think it was just another fishing boat. When it got within range, the boat swung around and the gun crews got the deck cannon ready. Subcommander Meiji Tagami had somehow gotten the impression that there was a submarine base at the mouth of the Columbia, and although not willing to risk his crew and mission getting close enough to see for sure, he thought a few artillery shells placed in the vicinity would send a valuable message to the Americans. You'll note that this wasn't too long after the Doolittle Raid on April 18, 1942, when a bunch of Army Air Force B-25 Mitchells dropped a few bombs on Tokyo in an attack that didn't really hurt the Japanese very much, but was definitely psychologically powerful. Perhaps a little reprisal was in order. So, under cover of darkness, miles out to sea, the I-25 opened fire. And for the first time ever, the state of Oregon was directly attacked by a wartime enemy. As it turned out, the place the I-25 was shelling was not a sub-base, but Battery Russell at Fort Stevens, and the hostile shellfire had an immediate effect on the place. Soldiers and officers leaped out of bed and started running around trying to get ready and go help return fire. In the dark, of course. Nobody was dumb enough to turn on a light and show the attackers what to shoot at. People tripped over stoves and crashed into trucks and cursed at each other as they scrambled to their battle stations in their underwear.
"We looked like hell,"
Captain Jack R. Wood, commander of the battery, told historian Bert Weber later.
"But we were ready to shoot back in a couple of minutes."
Well, they may have been ready, but the orders were to hold their fire. This was for several reasons. First, the big 10-inch guns designed to stop ships from coming into the Columbia could not tilt up high enough to lob shells to the attacking submarine. The 12-inch mortars couldn't reach it either. Shooting back might have made the crews feel better, but it would only have revealed the gun's position, relative size, and range to a submarine that they were pretty sure was on a reconnaissance mission. It could then go home and report that a nice big fleet of surface warships sitting 10 miles out to sea could pound Fort Stevens with impunity and then sail right up the Columbia River if it wanted to. Obviously, this could not be allowed to happen. So Fort Stevens sat there, simmering with collective frustration, and took it. 17 shells in all, without so much as a pistol shot in reply. And eventually the I-25's crew got tired of shelling the dark and unresponsive mainland and put the gun away and left. Behind, they left the smoking wreckage of a baseball diamond backstop, along with some slightly damaged power lines and a handful of holes in the ground. The total dollar damage done was probably under $20. Well, on its next visit to Oregon, the I-25 did better, if better is the right word. It got started out on September 9th by launching its onboard seaplane with a couple incendiary bombs and orders to use them to start a forest fire near Brookings. A few years earlier, the town of Bandon had been destroyed when a forest fire got into the gorse thickets and hedges that surrounded the town. Hoping to start something similar, Warrant Officer Nobuo Fujita buzzed inland in his tiny little Tinker Toy seaplane and gave it a shot, and then came back a few days later and tried again. Nothing came of this. The forest was too damp for an out-of-control burn to get going. But again, the I-25 was making history. It was the only wartime airstrike ever delivered on the American mainland before or since. By the way, the aircraft that Fujita was flying was officially referred to as a Type Zero, but it wasn't that Type Zero. It was an E-14Y Type Zero. It was sometimes referred to as an erector set airplane because they took it apart and put it and stowed it in the submarine in tiny little pieces. When it was time to get it out, they would drag the pieces out, assemble the seaplane, and launch it from a sort of a slingshot thing that was on the submarine's foredeck. Benton County historian Bill McCash has written a book about this whole operation called Bombs Over Brookings, and it's well worth looking up if you can find a copy of it. Between the airstrikes, Tagami's intrepid crew actually set the big sub down on the seafloor to make it less easy to detect. Several weeks later, the I-25 spotted a big merchant ship sitting still in the water. It was the SS Camden, which was taking a short break while its engineer took care of a few minor repairs in the engine room. 60 seconds and 2 torpedoes later, the ship was on fire. It sank later when its cargo of gasoline exploded while it was being towed to Seattle for salvage and one crew member drowned. The following day, the submarine sank a second ship off Gold Beach, the SS Larry Doheny, an oil tanker. 6 people died on this one. After that, the I-25 returned to Japan, stopping along the way to fire its last remaining torpedo into a surfaced Russian submarine. It never returned to Oregon waters. Wouldn't it be cool if we could lift that thing up off of the seafloor and bring it and park it in the Columbia River Maritime Museum up in Astoria? That would be so awesome. Unfortunately, what we believe is the I-25 is very, very deep indeed off the coast of Vanuatu. It's down there for good. We're never going to be able to get it. Well, that's it for today's episode. And if you're listening for the first time and would like some more information about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get everything at our central website at offbeatoregon.com. The complete catalog of about 185 columns going back to 2008, plus links to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes, and links out to the Facebook page and Twitter feed in case you'd like to join the conversation online. The website's also where you'll find full citations to sources for this story, which include books by Bill McCash, Bert Weber, Don Marshall, and Robert Cressman. Our theme music is a track titled Old Man's Waltz by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. Coming to Corvallis? Drop me a line and let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at Finn at offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, just plain at offbeatoregon. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the Oregon Centennial Party, which was thrown on 1959, 53 years ago today? It was quite a party. My article about it was written in early 2009, so it's one of the first ones I did. Look for that after about 6 a.m. tomorrow, that is Tuesday morning. In the meantime, go fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.